I think it is imperative for the government and NUMO to face residents squarely and provide them with sufficient information, including one that is inconvenient for them. The 2011 nuclear accident in Fukushima occurred after years of the government telling people that nuclear power plants were safe. Therefore, if the government only insists the disposal of nuclear waste is safe, people's anxieties will not be eased. The government should offer a full explanation, including certain risks associated with underground disposal, such as a possible failure to detect active faults. The government needs to show a willingness to answer any questions residents might have in a sincere manner.
In today's Insight, we heard the comments of NHK senior commentator Noriyuki Mizuno about the government's briefings on potential nuclear waste disposal sites.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
The indictment charges 13 Russian nationals and three Russian companies for committing federal crimes while seeking to interfere in the United States political system, including the 2016 presidential election. The defendants allegedly conducted what they called information warfare against the United States, with the stated goal of spreading distrust towards the candidates and the political system in general.
So, Masha Gessen, talk about what you found in reading the indictment, looking at how people are responding in Russia and here.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indus, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginal Radio.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Inteligente de Indigena.
So, you know, for somebody who actually has read the indictment, you know, in its entirety, and actually the Russian reporting that is almost entirely repeated in the indictment, it's really hard to square that with the way that it's been portrayed as, you know, sophisticated, bold effort. I think H.R. McMaster is correct in saying, yes, there's incontrovertible evidence of Russian meddling. But to call it bold, to call it sophisticated, and to imply that we now know that it actually had an influence on the outcome of the election is absurd. It was not bold, it was not sophisticated, and we don't know and probably never will know whether it had any impact.
Este es aborigen inteligente de radio, 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 radio.
Internet radio for smarter originals. Originals.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the people of the fourth world from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com, as well as our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my executive co-producer and master studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from Everyman Studios in Chinook and People's Territories, North America. I'm just going to get right into it, and I'm going to try, and I say that a lot, but I'm going to try not to be in here too long. It is what it is, folks. You know, I told you I'm burned out. You know, I'm tired of politics as it is in the United States because it's going no fucking where. You know, we get into, you know, petty little fucking crawls. And really, they're petty, bullshit fucking little crawls because, you know, nobody wants to back down. Nobody wants to admit that maybe they're fucking wrong. No one wants to admit that they're not being goddamn objective. You know, I mean, really. Really, and I'm talking about the left now. You know, I mean, the bullshit that happens on the right, well, we expect that. We expect it. It's part of their, you know, modus operandi. They will lie. They will take advantage of situations. They're self-centered. They're selfish. They're totally partisan in terms of their politics. They're partisan in terms of their theology. They're partisan in terms of their social beliefs. They're partisan in terms of their xenophobia. Now, I know that sounded, you know, like it didn't make any sense, right? And someone being partial in terms of their xenophobia. Well, you know, I've already said this. You know, you can fucking have an identity of who the fuck you are without being a fucking bigot. You know, without being a racist. You know, it's possible to be proud of being Italian, to be proud of being Greek, to be proud of being whatever the fuck, African, you know, whatever. Without being a fucking moron. But see, you know, we can't have that discussion. Matter of fact, we can't really discuss anything fucking objectively, but here's where I'm going with this. Russia hacking, Russian hacking, fake news, using the term fake news instead of propaganda and what have you. You know, the Russian government has completely turned us inside the fuck out. Why? What did I start off with? What did they play on? What did Trump get in on? Racism. Don't think, Barack Obama was some sort of antidote to this. He didn't do a goddamn thing about racism the entire motherfucking time he was in office. Yeah, he tried to elevate some other talented 10th type motherfuckers like himself, but on the whole, what did he do about racism? He had a beer with a racist fucking cop and said, there's wrong on both sides. Now, I'm no motherfucking fan of Skip Gates. By a long shot. But the bottom line is, really, Skip Gates is a Negro. I'm not talking about the type of Negro. He really fucking did this. And if you think I'm bullshitting, ask him. Ask him. Email him. Ask him. He has checked in with the local police stations, where he's lived as a professor, to say, hey, if you see a black guy going to such and such an address or walking down the street, it's me. And he will qualify it by saying, well, I'm a professor. Okay? You know, I'm educated and you don't have to worry about me. And he would talk about his white wife and his mixed race children. Yes, he did this. And, you know, Obama couldn't even back that up, right? So, you know, he had to still, you know, appease white people. And there were just as many black cops clapping for that racist son of a bitch. I mean, look, the man is trying to get into his own motherfucking home. He proved that that was his home. That should have been the motherfucking end of it. We also know, those of us who remember the fucking case, if you go back and look at it, the woman who called 911 didn't say a goddamn thing about race. You can actually get the recording of the call because the news station who spoke to released. The police gave them the motherfucking audio. She didn't, I mean, not the audio, I'm thinking about another case. Sorry, Luke. Thanks for catching me on that. The written, report. His written report. Oh no, wait a minute. We're both right. The written report was available because I've seen it and it didn't say a motherfucking thing about race. He actually changed that and it was found that he changed the documentation, that he augmented it. Nothing was done, right? But yeah, there was also the call. She didn't say anything about, you know, black. She said two men were trying to break in. But the bottom line is, those of you who remember the case, the Beer Summit is what they called it. Skip Gates was trying to get into his home. White cop shows up, and basically because, you know, he didn't like Gates' attitude, he arrested Gates in his own motherfucking house for trying to get into his own house. He didn't have his house keys or something. But that's the way Obama dealt with it. And let's remember, what were they saying about Obama? You know, people have a really short motherfucking memory because it happened this afternoon. I mentioned the same thing to somebody. You know, he was touted by white people as the perfect candidate, the perfect black candidate to deal with the racial issue. Why? They said it. He doesn't have a slaveholder's background. White liberals at the time said it. And no, I can't think of a name right now, but hey, go out there and prove me the fuck wrong. Just don't say, well, I never saw it, so fuck it, it never happened. It did happen. They said Obama was perfect because his father did not have a slave background. He was an African, as they put it, colonial, right? And then the Republican radio programs picked up on that and started identifying Barack Obama as a colonial African. Look it the fuck up. Not just Rush Limbaugh, not just Alex Jones, all those bullshit intellectuals that you think have some kind of motherfucking curry. You know, look at what the fuck they said about him and the nooses that were hung and the way they identified he and his wife and his children as fucking monkeys. The Klan, the White Patriot Party, the different neo-Nazi fucking groups, and the Nazi hipsters who they're calling the fucking alt-right. They allow themselves to reconfigure the motherfucking game, right? Same way the AfD in Germany has changed over to the Blue Party. It's in your fucking face. What else is in your face? Vladimir Putin is a hero to these motherfucking neo-Nazis. Did the Obama administration try to deal with the neo-Nazi rise? No. Did they try to deal with the fact that the Russians were fucking around and working with American neo-Nazis? No. Now, did the Obama administration have some kind of, you know, sanctions and prescriptions and shit against Russian influence and interference? Yeah. But then who was stopping them? Fucking Republicans, right? But there's no connection. I mean, how many goddamn people? Manafort, because that's really how you pronounce his name. Manafort, somebody told me, right? Paul Manafort, whatever the fuck. You got Gates here who just pled guilty. Manafort who pled guilty. Flynn pled fucking guilty. This other cat, I don't know, his name is what? Dutch, German, what? I don't know what the fuck. I never even heard of him until they mentioned his name the other day. And then you got all of the fucking Russian internet connected fucking interests. in the Mueller fucking indictment. And you got all these fucking people who are on the left, progressives, black supposed motherfucking radicals and shit, supposed intellectuals, who are out here saying, oh, they could not have influenced anything Hillary lost in her fucking policies. What the fuck are y'all talking about, man? She won the popular vote if the popular vote was fucking respected. If it wasn't for the Electoral College, we wouldn't be in this goddamn position.
Ever since losing last November's elections, the Democrats have made hatred of Russia the official religion of their political party. It's as if Democrats are channeling long-dead Republicans from the 1950s McCarthy era. We spoke with Ajanu Baraka, the former vice presidential candidate for the Green Party, a co-founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report.
You know, Glenn, if this was not happening in 2017, you would think that this was some plot out of a satirical movie. The fact that people are actually taking this stuff seriously, I think, reflects the real deterioration of politics in the U.S., but also common sense. What was interesting about this, too, is that it was obvious that the emperor has no clothes, and you call that out, then you become the one that is looked at with suspicion. I mean, what in the world could the Russians have done to influence the election? All of these allegations, all of this stuff that's circulating around, is based on the presumption that there was something that the Russians did that tilted the election to Trump. And if you ask the question what that something was, no one can answer. There's no evidence there was any kind of sophisticated hack of the voting machines. That's already been disputed. The only other thing they point to is the fact that there was a leak of the memos from the DNC that were damning in terms of how the Democrats were conspiring against Bernie Sanders. They claimed that that was a hack when everybody who's honest, they all know that basically this was a leak by someone who was, in fact, favorable to the Sanders campaign, that WikiLeaks, they're not in the business of hacking. So even with that, let's say the Russians did hack. What impact was that supposed to have had on the election, especially when the substance of the emails weren't even the object of discussion? It got shifted to whether or not it was the Russians who did it. So the fact of the matter is that the Democrats, along with elements within the state, have not come to terms with the fact that Donald Trump, an individual who no one took seriously at first, pulled off this political coup, if you will. And he is now occupying the top spot in this country. And so the objective, the fallback objective, of course, now is to basically undermine his ability to govern. And I think that they have up to now been quite successful with that. But the concern I have is that understanding the game being played in terms of Trump being the object of this effort by these very powerful interests, primarily the transnational bourgeoisie that's based in the U.S. What is interesting about this, Glenn, is how easy people who should be thinking more critically have fallen right in line with the Democratic Party talking points. And it is incredible that this is something that's now become the new common sense, so that even progressives are calling for further investigation. And further investigation, even at a moment when here, instead of the focus being shifted to real issues of substance, like the Trump budget, we're still talking about the Russians did it. It's absolutely insane.
Yes, we have something that's calling itself a resistance, but it seems to be a resistance to Donald Trump and not a resistance to policies put forward both by Donald Trump or policies that Donald Trump continues that comes from the previous administrations. Not resistance to those policies, but to an administration as such.
These are supposed to be political analysts, political fucking experts, and they're saying shit like this. This is fucking ridiculous. This is fucking ridiculous. We just saw one of the Parkland students. I saw this with Lupe a little bit before we came in here, right? Yeah, when we were at the cafe. That one of the... and I reposted it on my Twitter feed. And you should, if you want to. I would advise you to, if you want to find out what I'm talking about here and why I'm saying what I'm saying. At The Angry Indian on Twitter. And check out the news feed, of course, at Aboriginal Press on Twitter, of course. But in any case, a Parkland student has basically, a survivor of this shit, of this Nicholas Cruz neo-Nazi, you know, domestic terrorist that shot up his fucking school and murdered 17 of his goddamn classmates and whatever, you know, the teachers and shit that were there that were trying to protect them. Look, man. You know, what the fuck? People are really going to say that that the Russians couldn't have influenced anything with just putting out a bunch of ads against Hillary Clinton? Are you fucking kidding me? They didn't just do shit about Hillary Clinton. They were also promoting fucking neo-Nazism. They were promoting fucking white racism in this goddamn country. They were fucking encouraging people like Nicholas Cruz and Dylann Roof to do what the fuck they did. And John Lee Hauser and the rest of these fucking crazy people. But there's no way, I mean, okay, sorry. Yeah, thanks, Luke. What I was getting into before I went on that tangent is that I don't know this young man's name, but he's been bullied off of Facebook. He's had to close down his Facebook account because these Republican alt-right Russian supporting fuckers who got to have their goddamn, they got to sleep with an AR fucking 15. And we call them amosexuals for a goddamn fucking reason, right? They have bullied this young man off of fucking Facebook by accusing him and some of these other young people who are standing up for themselves of being crisis actors. The same shit they said during Sandy Hook. The same shit they said during all of these goddamn events. Including Las Vegas. You know, nobody really died, right? You know, this is just some FBI plot against Trump. Right, you know, these fucking events. And you know, what the fuck are you trying to say to me with a straight face that the influence of negative fucking media doesn't have any impact? They just bullied this young man off this fucking website, Facebook, right? You know, big time Facebook, which was which was part of this goddamn problem. They were selling fucking ad space to these, I mean, whether they knew about it or didn't know about it, they certainly didn't try to fucking stop it until they got called out on it. Same thing with Twitter. And didn't the executives of Facebook, in terms of Zuckerberg and some of his other underlings, and in terms of whoever the fuck it is that owns Twitter, weren't they supporting Trump doing all of this shit?
What it tells us about our imagination, about the Russian imagination. So Russia imagines America and the American political system as like this unassailable monolith that they're throwing stuff at just to try to make a dent. Whereas the United States is starting to increasingly to imagine Russia as all powerful, as incredibly sophisticated, as capable of, you know, sending out some really absurd tweets in subliterate English and somehow changing the outcome of the election. And that projects such a belief in the fragility of the system and the basic instability of it and in the gullibility of voters who, you know, read something that's not even, comprehensible English and suddenly change their vote. I mean, the working theory of the investigation, right, is that Russians influenced the election by influencing American public opinion.
Motherfucking archives. That's what the point of the fucking archive is for out there, right? Go fucking look at it. Look up the god, you know, I swear to God, you know, people just like, they're looking for information that they want to see, rather than looking for what the fuck is going on out there. And, you know, I got some audio here because I don't want you to just fucking believe me. But it's really some bullshit out here, man, for fucking people who claim to be political goddamn analysts. To say, oh, the Russians couldn't have really had any kind of effect. It's bullshit that they had any kind of effect by putting out some bullshit information out there after Pizzagate. Pizzagate caused a young, white, radical fucking fool to go down to, was it Comet Pizza? Is it Comet Pizza? Luke? Comet Pizza down here in fucking Washington, D.C. with a field-grade fucking weapon. I don't know if it was an AR-15 or not. He goes down there to conduct his own fucking investigation to free the kids that supposedly are being held at Comet Pizza in an underground fucking chamber. Turns out there is no basement to that goddamn building. It also turns out that Mike Cernovich, the motherfucker that started that bullshit, went on goddamn some interview and admitted that he just started that bullshit and said, well, I wanted to. He knew that it was going to hurt the Democrats by putting that bullshit out, and he flat out said, I made it up, so what? You can't do anything about it. You know? I mean, how did that have any cachet in the first place? Because we know full fucking well that there are pedophiles out there, and we know full well that there are fucking pedophile rings. But you're going to come out and say that there's a pedophile ring connected to the DNC after Denny Hastert? Or how about, you know, when I said the time to take down the Republican Party is now. You can't find that motherfucking article. I don't even have a copy of it because I've lost hard drives since then. That bullshit was wiped from the motherfucking internet. Why? Well, I don't know. Let me see. I was writing about Jerry Sandusky, and I was naming names, and I was pointing out how many people in the fucking Republican Party in Pennsylvania, the state of Pennsylvania, that were attached to that goddamn school, that were attached to that fucking football program, knew that Sandusky was a goddamn aggressive fucking pedophile, and kept protecting him. Remember when Joe Paterno died? Remember when Joe Paterno died? Right? Joe Paterno died. This motherfucking enabler. This enabler. He passes away after being fucking disgraced. What did the white kids do at that goddamn school? They tore the motherfucking place apart. They beat up reporters. They turned over a goddamn mainstream news studio van. I think it was ABC News. They turned the fucking van over with the staff goddamn inside, right? Set fire to shit, you know, rubbish bins and some other fucking things. There wasn't one motherfucking arrest. There wasn't one motherfucking arrest. That was a goddamn riot, but there wasn't one motherfucking arrest. And the GOP and the Republicans defended them getting angry. For defending a motherfucker who defended a goddamn pedophile. Now, if Pizzagate had any kind of fucking credibility at all, they would have gone after the GOP motherfuckers that defended Sandusky. But they didn't. They would have gone after Denny Hastert. But they didn't. They would have gone after Tom the Hammer fucking DeLay, who defended what they talk about in Pizzagate in the Marianas goddamn Islands. But they didn't. Matter of fact, they could have talked about the Franklin goddamn scandal. Remember that one? But see, they don't want to talk about the Franklin scandal. You know, the Franklin scandal has been quote-unquote discredited. But the thing about the Franklin scandal is, the Franklin scandal involved Republicans. Look up Lawrence King and the fucking Franklin scandal. When we talk about black Republicans, let's talk about a fucking low-life scumbag named Lawrence fucking King out of Kansas. Okay, that was making money for the fucking Republican Party in Kansas hand over goddamn foot. And they knew that he was procuring orphans, abandoned youths and shit that were being farmed out for abuse. The Republican Party was at the goddamn center of that shit. Nothing. Nothing. And you never hear any Pizzagate motherfucker bring it up ever. You just don't. Even though the fucking data is out there. They just ignore it. They just motherfucking ignore it. They fucking ignore it. You know, so yeah, Obama didn't do shit about racism. And the Republicans who are so worried about goddamn child abuse, which they fucking should be. I mean, what? Jeffrey Epstein. Isn't he a friend of Donald Trump's? Isn't that motherfucker in the joint right now for fucking the abuse of children? Could you imagine if that was a DNC figure that got tied up like this? I mean, look at what the fuck. Yeah, I know people still, you know, just realize it. What the fuck happened with Al Franken? You know, they were angry with me for about a week or two until they realized what the fuck happened. when Farenthold wasn't leaving, or none of those other goddamn Republicans who have been charged when they decided that they were not stepping down. A Republican governor just got arrested today for abusing a woman, tying her up and taking a photograph of her and basically blackmailing her that if you leave me or tell my wife about our motherfucking affair, I'm going to use this shit to discredit you and ruin your motherfucking name all over town. Right? He tried some Ray Donovan shit and it backfired. So fucking he's fucked up, but he's GOP. Do you hear any of them yelling a fucking moral anything? No. How many women have accused Trump? This motherfucker's on tape talking to Billy Bush, talking about, well, you know, I never said what I said when I talked about basically feeling him up because, you know, I can. I didn't say that. Then he says, oh, you know, teachers should be armed and we're going to give them bonuses. But I didn't say that. I said concealed carry. That's not the same thing as arming teachers. Huh? But the left doesn't know what the fuck to do. You know, you got Russians who are going to... This isn't me. Look at the goddamn New York Times. Just look at the fuck up. Russians going to Florida to Trump hotels, Trump fucking resorts, and having babies so that they can have... So they, their children can get Russian... I mean, U.S.-Russian motherfucking co-citizenship, which I didn't think was possible. I thought you couldn't do that. These motherfuckers are against immigration like that, but not when they're Russians. Not when they're paying the fucking Trump family. Right? How many people have lied about meeting the motherfucking Russians? Flynn? Manafort? Come on, man. Kushner? You got to be fucking kidding me. Oh, there was no collusion. Are you fucking kidding me? Gates just goddamn admitted that there was a fucking conspiracy. This is what he's pleading guilty to. What the fuck is everybody talking about? And then they tried to play both ends against the fucking middle with, oh, well... Okay, they bought some ads because that's already been proven. They bought a lot of goddamn ads. That's been proven already. That's empirical. That's fucking documented goddamn fact. Oh, but that didn't have any impact. What was the name of that sister, Lou? The one who... Leslie Jones. Leslie Jones, who she had to leave Twitter because of the way she was harassed by... Milo Yiannopoulos, is that how you pronounce his fucking name? You know, I mean, he's not even American, and he's gay. And these motherfuckers were, you know, all over him. Oh, everything he says, oh, dangerous faggot tour, all this bullshit. You know, again, the type of motherfucker who's like, hang him, lynch them, not me. Run past me, I will help you. I will point out to you what tree they're hiding behind. Lynch them, not me. I will play violins while you lynch them and eat your motherfucking food while you watch. You know, while you picnic. And no, picnic does not have to do with pick a nigga. That's wrong. Wrong. It's a French word. You got that shit wrong. It's like the $2 goddamn bill and, you know, no, that's wrong. That's just wrong. It's just wrong. And this is what I'm talking about. We're picking and choosing what information we want to motherfucking accept. And what I'm saying is with these professional motherfucking leftists, and I'm saying it like that. Oh, well, America's fucked up and the CIA does all kinds of shit in other countries. Oh, so what? It doesn't matter then that they fuck up the black vote, right? So it doesn't matter that they help create a motherfucking climate that allows the FBI to say, okay, black identity extremists, we're coming after you. Because, you know, social media shit doesn't have any motherfucking impact on how people think. Remember the, I don't remember the name of it, Luke, the artificial intelligence that some university or lab or whatever the fuck they came up with, and she became racist within 3 days. By going what the fuck, you know, picking up shit from, you know, algorithms from the motherfucking internet. The shit became sexist and racist within fucking 3 days, to the point where they had to stop the goddamn program. What is that saying? What is that saying? I mean, the hate has always fucking been here. And there's all kinds of fucking information on the net if you go look for it. If you have the time to fucking look for it. A lot of people gotta work. If you got the time to look for it and you have enough education, and yeah, don't get angry when I say this. It's the fucking truth. I don't give a fuck how smart you goddamn are. If you're not educated and if you have no fucking training, no, you don't understand a lot of this shit that's going on. If I wasn't trained in advertising my goddamn self, if I wasn't trained as a political fucking activist. I've talked about this. Ralph Shulman was one of my goddamn instructors back in the 80s. I mean, a lot of the other names I don't remember, but I remember him because he had some of the most impact on me. But I was actually trained by political fucking people, career political people. And, you know, a lot of you who are fucking talking about, well, you know, I'm an analyst and this, that, and the other. How the fuck are you analyzing anything if you're just going to fucking use the information that you choose to analyze shit? I've had to fucking, you know, change entire goddamn essays because I was either wrong because of what I was reading and then found some contradictory fucking information later on and went back. How many people are really motherfucking doing that? How many, like Black Agenda Report? Are they going to admit that they're fucking wrong about this shit? They were wrong from the goddamn beginning. They were wrong from the fucking beginning. You know, and I can't speak for them in terms of what their particular issue with this shit is, in terms of why they're supporting the motherfucking Russians like this, because I've also talked about this. You hear the shit that I say on this show. You all know how the fuck I am about indigenous goddamn politics. And there was a point for about a year, maybe a year and a half, that fucking RT, Russia Today, was sending me news bits. Now, why would they do that? I mean, two of the producers from Democracy Now! At one point used to send me things too. But see, why was the Russian state media service sending me leads? And, you know, at first, you know, and of course, psychologically, you're like, oh, okay, well, I must be doing some really good motherfucking work out here. They're taking the time and, you know, they notice me and they're, you know, they're offering some shit. They've offered to, there was at least two messages where they were putting shit out for journalists and I was, you know, supposedly chosen, quote unquote, to participate in this. And I never did. But what I'm trying to say to you is, why wouldn't they reach out to somebody who says, hey, you know, Native Americans are being fucked over, Black people are being fucked over, they're trying to cause dissent in the fucking country, why wouldn't they try to motherfucking, you know, tag somebody like me? Or Black Agenda Report, or CPR Metro, all of us fringe, and I'm saying that. How many people listen to this show, Luke? Depending on what we talk about, right? I mean, we've had a couple of fucking shows that were like, you know, 1,000 downloads each. But it was because we did a lot of pushing it, and I was, you know, DMing the shit to people, and, you know, here it is. And we said something, you know, that was obviously controversial, so it got some play. But that's it. You know, I mean, there are not a whole lot of fucking people listening to this, and I'm aware of that. And I acknowledge that. It is what the fuck it is. But see, why wouldn't they approach somebody like me? We're going to be snubbed by MSNBC or whoever the fuck else, CNN, whatever the fuck, right? Or even maybe a Democracy Now. We're not going to be taken seriously by a lot of these groups. So what are you going to do? You're going to reach out to a motherfucker like, you know, pick anybody. Anybody. Anderson Cooper, any of them. They're not going to motherfucking respond to some Russian fucking thing. You know, oh yeah, well, hey. Help us spread some fucking information that we want spread. No, they're not going to do that. They're going to go to the people who are already outside the motherfucking system. Who are, again, fringe. And when I say fringe, doesn't necessarily mean bad. But it certainly doesn't mean you're in the fucking mainstream. Because you're not. CPR Metro is run by Don DeBar. And, you know, from what I can find out about him, he's from upstate New York and some shit. And he's just one of these old-time fucking American communists who, you know, no matter what the U.S. goddamn does, even if it does get his shit straightened out, he's still going to talk about something that happened fucking 40 years ago that may or may not have any goddamn relevance to what the fuck is going on now. It really doesn't fucking matter. But the shit that I was listening to his on his motherfucking podcast, I still listen to it. And it's just like, yeah, well, you know, the United States is just, you know, it's just so fucking corrupt. You know, why are we even fucking talking about it? You know, it's just, we already know the goddamn United States is fucking corrupt. So, okay, fine. So the U.S. turns over the fucking Iranian government, the Venezuelan goddamn government, Obiang's shit, they keep him in power, right? They were okay with Idi Amin Dada. Then when they decided they didn't motherfucking like him, they helped. The Israelis get rid of them, right? Because the Israelis were backing them when the U.S. stopped backing them, right? So, you know, all these things. Anybody who is politically fucking savvy already goddamn knows this. And, you know, like Jeremy Scahill, somebody I respect, but I'm really kind of getting tired of him too. Unless is he's just responding to what he's hearing. Where is he? D.C., New York, wherever the fuck he is. Somewhere in the East Coast. That people are just forgetting about CIA and FBI malfeasance. Nobody's forgetting about a goddamn thing. So, but we're supposed to say now that the CIA and the FBI would not be telling the truth about the fucking Russians? Wait a fucking minute for a second. What is the job of the CIA and the FBI in the fucking first place? And I'm sorry, I know a lot of people like to think this, but their entire fucking rationale in life is not to stomp on black people and Native Americans. Their job is actually to keep the motherfucking system in place. That's exactly what the fuck they're supposed to do. Right? And having the Russians come in here and have this kind of fucking influence isn't helping them worth a goddamn. It's not. It's not helping anybody except the Trumps, because they just want to get what the fuck they can get. They don't give a fuck if the rest of the country falls apart. They don't give a fuck if the Russian mafia comes in here. Well, they're already here any goddamn way, right? But, you know, they don't care if they come in here and take over. They don't give a fuck. They're trying to make their own goddamn money. Where is Don Jr. now? He's in India, right? Selling the Trump brand, isn't he? Where's Ivanka right now? South Korea, isn't she supposed to speak to some? You know, what the fuck is going on here? They're making money hand over goddamn fucking foot, taking full goddamn advantage of the fucking fact. Well, they're taking advantage of the system, but that's a given. They're taking advantage of the fact that the fucking left here, the radical left anyway, is still fucking harping about, oh, well, you know, Hillary Clinton's policies. If Hillary Clinton's policies were that goddamn bad, then why did she get 3 million or damn near 4 million fucking votes more than fucking Trump? If you look at it, almost nobody fucking voted for Trump except his hardcore fucking fools and a bunch of libertarians who think that they're edgy. And white people who, if they couldn't get Bernie Sanders, then they were going to go for Trump any motherfucking way, because they're voting for their own best fucking interests. So, you know, these motherfucking arguments that are right here, you know, are making no motherfucking sense. If you're going to believe conspiracy theories about George Soros, because the National Endowment for Democracy, which has a corrupt fucking history, it was created by the CIA to basically mask their motherfucking activities. Most of us know this already. This is a fucking given. But because George Soros decides, okay, well, they do fucked up shit, but I'm going to do this. Well, he's trying to make money for himself. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, wow. He's a fucking capitalist. Of course he is. But he just also happens to be on the fucking left wing when it comes to politics. You can actually be fucking both, you know? And I don't know why, you know, people who come down on Soros for being rich and working with the National Endowment for Democracy, was like I just fucking said, quote me, is corrupt. But they're defending Jill Stein, who has how much motherfucking stock, her and her husband both, in fossil fuels, in all the fucking shit that she talks against. She owns stock in these goddamn ventures. But for some reason, the left does not, even Democracy Now! Has not called her out on this shit. She was sitting there with all of them. And this is what I'm trying to say. You don't get to be there unless you're doing what the fuck they want. If she wasn't saying something that was detrimental to the fucking system, that wasn't going to tear up some shit, that wasn't going to put confusion somewhere, do you really think she would have fucking been there? I don't give a fuck who paid for her goddamn trip. She sat at the fucking table with Putin, with Flynn, with whoever the fuck else was there. I said, you know, come the fuck on, man. How stupid can people fucking be? Jill Stein is in on this shit. Jill Stein is in on it for her fucking self. If you're going to get on George Soros for being a motherfucking a capitalist, then how the fuck can you not get on Jill Stein for owning capitalist fucking stock? And why am I saying this? Because you got people out here, including myself. I used to squat, okay? That's how serious I took this shit. You know, back in the motherfucking day, man, and to this day, Because I've talked about it here. I don't make nearly as much as I should be making. And I have really dinged myself. And really, you know, because like I said, I've lost the marriage over this shit. You know, taking my politics fucking serious to the point where I would not do certain jobs. No matter how much the fuck they paid me, because I figured, what the fuck? And yeah, you know, being a fucking, you know, looking the way I do and, you know, sounding white and all that kind of bullshit. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of white companies that tried to put me into positions to where, you know, I'm going to go around. I'd be their face for black folks to basically convince them to come in on some shit that really wasn't doing them any motherfucking good. And I turned down those motherfucking positions. I've turned down money. You understand? So you got people out there who are fucking living hand to mouth, holding fast to their motherfucking politics, who are out here in the street getting clubbed, getting gassed. I mean, that's what happened with fucking Occupy, and also facing assassination. That also happened with Occupy. Look at the fuck up. Look at Naomi Wolf and how many fucking times those people who were doing Occupy were actually marked for assassination. The FBI stopped it, but they never prosecuted the people or let it be publicly known who was behind the hits. And why was it that no one was actually killed? Because they couldn't identify who the fuck the leaders were. That's why. Read Naomi Wolf on that shit. Don't believe me.
The child hippies, and so my formative memories were of very moving, powerful protests that I knew were changing things, not just politically, but also kind of spiritually in a way, like people were being changed and society was being changed. So I did some research to find out, and instinctively, I mean, that marches I've been on lately, for the last decade, they really are, that you do feel impotent. You feel like you're engaging in some kind of weird Disneyland activism. You know, like there's going to be kind of Mickey Mouse and Snow White with a banner, you know, in front of me. It's like totally fake somehow. Why is that? So I did some research and I discovered, and many of you are lawyers, you'll appreciate this, that actually there's been, it feels fake because it is fake now. I discovered that for 30 years, there's been a systematic effort on the part of those who benefit from a small group of people holding power, a systematic effort to kill off effective protest by a death by a thousand cuts of bureaucracy, over permitticization in jurisdiction after jurisdiction. So what do I mean by this? Is it okay if I feel like I can't see the people in the back? I'm just going to sit up a little. I looked at places where protest made a difference. Actually, I took one step back. In trying to answer the question, how do you save a nation from being closed by an oligarchy that wants to close democracy? I looked at other times and places where citizens effectively pushed back against would-be dictators. And one thing that came up again and again and again is mass protest. Not only did it come up, but mass protest always works. Always works. I mean, unless the leaders are willing to literally send out the military with submachine guns and mow people down, mass protests like the kind you saw in Pakistan, the kind you saw with people power in the Philippines, the kind you saw all over the Baltic states, Estonia, when they were bringing down the Soviet Union, the kind you saw in East Germany, always works. The civil rights movement, mass protest. Okay, so what kind of mass protest? The kind of mass protest that always works is illegal just about everywhere in the United States today. Why is that? For a protest to be effective, you have to stop traffic. You have to stop traffic. What keeps you from getting a permit in the United States? Stepping a foot into the street. Now, why do you have to stop traffic? Because for a protest to do anything, it has to disrupt business as usual. I don't mean violence. Whoever's tape recording this, take it back to, you know, Quantico or whatever. I don't mean violence. I mean dissent. You know, Martin Luther King, who wrote Letter from Birmingham Jail because he marched without a permit, said sometimes it is important for the tension to rise up, for people to see that all is not well, and that you do that by stopping traffic. That's how citizens indicate, you know, business as usual is not acceptable. And by the way, The founders did this all the time, up and down the Eastern Seaboard in the 1760s, 1770s, 1780s. Mass protests of ordinary citizens who didn't like the British crown, and they dismantled the, you know, tax collectors' mansions brick by brick till there was not a brick standing. Or, you know, then they had their nation and they didn't like what, you know, President Washington was doing with foreign policy. So they had mass protests that brought everything to a halt, in city after city. This is the American mandate. Okay, so now we cannot do it, because if you are going to do that, you can't get a permit. And even so, there's this crazy section in Give Me Liberty where I try to use all my liberties as the founders intended. And I found out that it's illegal to stage a rally for the Constitution in Union Square without a permit. It's illegal, even with a permit, to use a megaphone. You know, meanwhile, commercial music is blasting out in Union Square. And I try to think about, you know, registering my neighbors to vote, and I realize I'm risking $5,000. You know, it's illegal to make a mistake, an innocent mistake. And, you know, that you can't, you know, oh my God, if you try to get a friend to run for Senate in Virginia, you know, you go two clicks in and then you realize you need to hire a lawyer because you could be breaking the law if you have a bake sale, you know, and you need a bake sale to get the money to hire the lawyer. Mm-hmm. And I realize, and of course, this is very, that last one is important because campaign finance reform necessitated, mm-hmm. But apart from that, barrier after barrier after barrier has been deliberately set in the place of citizens to keep them from leading the nation. And so back to protest, there's this systematic neutering of our marches. So yes, you can get a permit to go from here on the mall to here on the mall. That changes, pardon me, all. It changes nothing. And it will never change anything. And whether the media covers it or not, it will never change anything.
Don't believe me. Read a goddamn basic book on fucking propaganda. Read Walter Lippmann if you really, you know, for those of you who are Chomsky fans. I mean, goddamn, look this shit up. Look it the fuck up. A bad rumor can get somebody fucking killed. Are we going to say that that's not motherfucking true? You know, that's all bullshit. You know, that has no effect. No effect at all. The entire fucking point of the Me Too campaign is women are being fucked over. Women are being fucked over. And, you know, we're going to use the Me Too hashtag, even though a black woman started it, it's still fucking being traced to Rose McGowan and a bunch of other white women, even though a black woman started that. And yeah, there's some sisters that are still mad at me about this loop, but show me where I'm fucking wrong. If the woman that started, I can't remember her name, Burke? Is that her name? If the sister that started Me Too, who actually started Me Too, looked like Beyonce, we would have heard about this shit a long motherfucking time ago. We would have heard about this shit a long time ago. But see, but we don't want to admit that. We don't want to admit that looks and being pretty, we will pay more attention to you if we like the way you look. If you come across a certain way. So what did the Russians do? They knew that the United States is motherfucking racist to its goddamn core, just like Russia. So they fucking played on it. And the neo-Nazis fucking helped them. And Trump was taking money from them and planning to take more motherfucking money from them. The NRA has been taking money from them, but there's no conspiracy. Even though Gates has admitted there was a conspiracy. And you know, something else I want to say real quick. Because a lawyer friend of mine pointed this out. She was like, you know, I'm kind of sick and tired of people talking about they looked at the indictment and they didn't see any evidence. The whole point of the indictment is to say this is what this individual is being charged with and that we have the evidence, or we believe that we have enough evidence to fucking charge them. They're not laying out the motherfucking evidence in the indictment. I mean, you know, lawyers are like, hey, people who are saying this don't know a fucking thing about the law. They also don't know a goddamn thing about documentation. I know that for a fucking fact. A lot of folks use the term document like they're holding gold. You know, this document. So the fuck what, man? I read documents from the United Nations and from the EU and shit that's released publicly all the fucking time. A lot of that does not tell you every motherfucking thing. An indictment is just that. We have enough evidence to charge this motherfucker to be in charge with this, that, and the other, and we got evidence to prove it. Doesn't mean they're going to lay out every goddamn thing that comes out in court.
Indictments, and it's being tagged as meddling or interference is some of the words that have been used to describe. I've also taken a look at the indictment itself. We had some local media that linked to it, provided a PDF file, and it's really much to do about nothing. Is it something that you should be concerned about, that you should be watchful about? Yes. The only laws that were broken were identity theft and fraud, wire fraud, and transferring money to individuals using setting up fake accounts like on PayPal, buying, and these are allegations contained in the indictment, the grand jury indictment from special counsel Robert Mueller. And really, though, he should be fired. Trump should get rid of him. Millions of dollars spent to look for so-called collusion between the Russian government and the Trump campaign, and all you can come up with is an alleged troll farm that funded political activities primarily based on the First Amendment. But I do get the criminal charges. You use stolen identities of real Americans. You set up these bank accounts. You put money in these bank accounts. How much money? I still haven't come across. I don't know if hundreds of millions were spent, if a million was spent, if it was 50,000. I'm simply not privy to that information right now, haven't come across it in any of the media that I have been reading. But so they set up these fake accounts so that they could then pay for or contribute payments towards putting on rallies. Some of the rallies were for Trump, some were anti-Trump after he got elected. Also mentioned in the indictment, there was some personal financial gain that might have been had, so there's motive enough right there. But what I can't get past, what does not meet the smell test, is that this was some grand conspiracy to interfere in the 2016 elections. Some of the headlines talk about influence, but everybody has an opinion. Everybody has a viewpoint, and everybody has an agenda, pretty much. We hope that there's more people with a justice agenda, specifically when it comes to abolishing legalized slavery, which is practiced here in the United States. But, you know, everybody has an agenda, and they're going to try to influence people. Now, how much influence they have, that remains to be seen. It was not enough influence, in my professional opinion, as a political analyst, for all these years going on, 10 years of political reporting and analysis. And this does not meet the smell test politically and how it's trying to be portrayed. But let's go ahead and
The Tea Party, when they were talking about, well, I haven't seen Obama's birth certificate. And I asked a couple of these Cracker Barrel motherfuckers, what expertise do you have to be able to validate whether or not Obama's birth certificate was valid, even if you could see it? Even if you got on a goddamn plane and went to fucking Hawaii to look at it. Who the fuck are you, and what experience do you have? What are your fucking qualifications to look at that document and say, yeah, well, yeah, this is fake or it isn't? Well, I haven't seen his birth certificate. Who the fuck are you? I haven't seen his birth certificate. Same thing with this shit. Mother talking about, well, I haven't seen any evidence. Do you work for the fucking FBI? You know, do you work for the fucking, for the Mueller team? So what access do you have that the rest of us haven't fucking seen? You know, we already know that these motherfuckers bought up tons of goddamn ads on this shit. Nobody's even denying that now. Most of the motherfuckers who have been decrying this don't even deny that anymore, because they can't. They're just making the argument and hanging on to it for dear life. Well, this doesn't mean that anything really happened, that anybody was influenced by this shit. No, you know, people are just influenced by Pizzagate, but they wouldn't be influenced by the Russians. you know, Pepe the Frog and all that kind of shit, you know, that had no motherfucking effect whatsoever on people. No effect whatsoever. And no effect on the fact that we've had white terrorism in Charlottesville, Portland, Oregon here, right? Motherfucking Florida, you know, Charleston, you know, nothing. We're still not looking at white people as, you know, white conservative males who are gun lovers as a fucking threat. We're talking about black identity extremists, which is the same shit that they were promoting. They were promoting this. The Russians were promoting this through their troll mills. But there are black fucking people out here saying that the Russians are innocent because they haven't seen any fucking evidence. Like, they would know any evidence if they fucking saw it. Because, like I said, they can believe in every goddamn stupid conspiracy theory out here. That, like, say, for example, the young man I spoke to yesterday, I told you about, Luke, that believes that the Protocols of Zion is real. He's a black Muslim, and he believes this. But he doesn't believe that Putin fucking did this. And, hang on here, he said that the Russians are communists, and the communists in Russia have always been our friends. How many times have I mentioned that I've spoken to black folks who think for some motherfucking reason Putin is a communist? They think that the fucking Russian system is still communist. But they're experts in politics, and they're you know, they do analysis, right? And the evidence that they've seen, even though the evidence is pretty fucking clear that that these motherfuckers have put a fucking, you know, their fist in the ass of black people here in the United States, by helping the motherfucking Nazis, by helping the Trump administration, which is working with the fucking Nazis, they're not even looking at white identity extremists anymore for the terrorist watch list. They're focusing exclusively on Muslims and black folks, right? Because you got that activist from the Guerrilla Family Network or whatever the fuck it is, because they got three or four different fucking names down there in Texas. As far as I know, he's still being held in the federal joint. Like I said, you know, he apparently has a history of domestic abuse and all that type of shit. And yeah, that should be addressed. And that obviously that's why a lot of white progressives have stopped supporting him. And you don't really see any goddamn thing about it anymore. But the bottom line is, you know, here are black people who don't real, who think they know what the fuck they're talking about and don't. Who have basically, you know, allowed the far right, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, or, you know, whatever language you want to motherfucking use to come up in the fucking, yeah, I mean, just right up under the system of black folks and got you believing not just flat earth bullshit or that, Planned Parenthood is out here to kill you. But now they got you convinced that their white supremacist hero, Vladimir Putin, is your friend. And you're buying this. And you're parroting all the fucking shit that they're saying. And you want motherfucking, you know, you just won't admit to yourself, oh, I might have fucked up. Like, because who wants to admit that they're fucking wrong? Especially after you done went and showed your ass. Right? You know, I mean, it's just like the same thing with these people who are about that Roswell bullshit in New Mexico. Man, let it the fuck go. All right? Let it the fuck go. But see, they can't. Because you got people who've been talking about that shit for decades. They've been making billions as an industry for the past few decades. You think they want that fucking gravy train to stop? Absolutely goddamn not. So, you know, with this, a lot of it is a matter of motherfucking embarrassment. They couldn't stand Hillary fucking Clinton. Okay, fine. I'm not a fan of hers either. You know, I was very adamant about the super predator bullshit and bring them to fucking heel. But the fuck if I'm going to side with another goddamn government, especially one that has a history of racism against black people? Yeah, I mean, you think Africans in Russia are being treated well? You're a motherfucking idiot, man. You're a goddamn idiot. Read what the fuck they say. There's enough black Russian blogs talking about what the fuck they have to put up with and how bad the neo-Nazi shit is over there. I mean, it's like, what the fuck is wrong with y'all, man? But you can see conspiracies every goddamn way, except the ones that are right under your fucking nose, which was the whole point. Well, it wasn't a sophisticated attack. No, so they should just, you know, lay it the fuck out so that they can be traced, right? Oh, yeah, well, we know for a fact that you did it. Come the fuck on. This was the perfect fix. And you fuckers don't get it. They knew that we were so goddamn confused over here that this shit would work. And exactly what's happening is what the fuck they planned. That we'd be arguing amongst ourselves and not really understanding what the fuck happened. Which is exactly what the fuck happened. Because once we realized what the fuck happened, nobody wanted to admit this shit. Nobody wanted to admit what the fuck was going on. Because that means what? We got fooled. We got suckered. And who the fuck wants to say that? Same thing with the white folks who support Trump. They're still saying they support him. I don't agree with them on this, but why are you still supporting him? Well, yeah, because you fucking voted for him. You're a Republican. That's what you identify with. And, you know, you don't want to be self-goddamn convicting. All right, so let's continue to blame immigrants. Let's continue to blame black folks. Let's continue to blame angry natives and shit over the Dakota Access Pipeline. Let's not look at white extremism. Let's not look at the fucking fact that the white extremist movement in the United States has been pally with the fucking Russian neo-Nazis since the motherfucking late 80s. They have never broken that goddamn connection. And the Russians made use of that fucking connection. You know, and it, the idea that people, you know, I don't see any evidence where people could be swayed. But then, what about these alt-right motherfuckers? Yeah, what about them? Who helped them? Use your fucking heads. This is the Angry Indian. Please, stay tuned.
I'm Andrew Westmoreland. I'm a journalist. And we just, you know, we go out into the community and we find stories that have national importance. You can follow me on Twitter at @DrewWest_press. And you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
In Parkland, Florida, the sun rises with 17 fewer children and adults. 17 fewer children and adults violently taken away from parents and families on Wednesday. The following are the names of Republicans and their career totals paid by the National Rifle Association to ensure gun laws never change and more innocent children and adults are murdered. 1. Senator John McCain, Arizona. $7,740,000. 2. Senator Richard Burr, North Carolina. $6,986,000. Number 3. Senator Roy Blunt, Missouri. $4,551,000. Number 4. Senator Tom Tillis, North Carolina. $4,418,000. 5. Senator Cory Gardner, Colorado, $3,879,000. Number 6, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, $3,303,000. 7, Senator Joni Ernst, Iowa, $3,124,000. 8, Senator Rob Portman, Ohio, $3,061,000. 9. Senator Todd Young, Indiana, $2,896,000. 10. Senator Bill Cassidy, Louisiana, $2,861,000. 11. Senator Tom Cotton, Arkansas, $1,968,000. 12. Senator David Perdue, Georgia, $1,825,000. 13. Senator Pat Roberts, Kansas, $1,584,000. 14. Senator Pat Toomey, Pennsylvania, $1,467,000. 15. Senator Ron Johnson, $1,269,000. 16. Senator Mitch McConnell, $1,261,000. And 17th, Representative French Hill, Arkansas, $1,089,000. These are the names of 17 Republicans paid by the National Rifle Association to make sure gun manufacturers keep their power and money, no matter the cost in blood. A historic footnote. Since 26 people were killed in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, more than 430 people have been shot in 273 school shootings. We do not have to tolerate thoughts and prayers. Quite a few of these Republicans are running for re-election. Register. Vote them out. In the meantime, join the movement. Go to every town. www.AndrewSynth.org.
This is Radio Anglo-Indian. Anglo-Indian Radio for the Fourth World.
Imagine, if you will, that the most frightening things on Earth are about to come out of the darkness. They will look surprisingly like your neighbors, your friends, your family.
This situation must be controlled before it's too late. They are multiplying too rapidly.
Now accept the fact that there's no escaping the awful consequences.
We've got to survive. Somebody's got to survive.
When there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth. Dawn of the Dead.
They must be destroyed on sight.
There is nothing you can do to stop it. It's too late. It's already happening at a theater near you. Dawn of the Dead contains scenes of violence that may be considered shocking. No one under 17 will be admitted. Dawn of the Dead from United Film Distributing Company.
Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/HideInCopFire.
Roseanne Cash, for the American Association of Diabetes Educators.
Johnny Cash was my dad. For years he had diabetes but ignored it, even as his vision and health slipped away. Diabetes is serious. It can steal your sight, your limbs, even take you away from the people who love you. But it doesn't have to be this way. If you have diabetes, test and control your blood sugar regularly. You'll be healthier and you'll feel better too. To learn more, visit healthywithdiabetes.org.
Missy Elliott for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed, get tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
Turkish troops have crossed their southern border into the Afrin province of Rojava, the autonomous Kurdish community in northern Syria defended by the YPG. Recep Erdogan claims that they're only going into Syria in order to defeat ISIS, despite the fact there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that the YPG are supporting ISIS in any way. In fact, the complete opposite. They have been the most effective force at repelling ISIS insurgents throughout northern Syria. So much so that the Americans have effectively outsourced much of their military effort in Syria by training Kurdish troops and supplying them with weapons. The US, who nominally support the Kurds in their fight against ISIS, have completely betrayed the YPG in reference to the invasion of the NATO-backed Turkish forces from the north. Only a few months after signing an agreement to train additional Kurdish troops in northern Syria, the US have completely capitulated to the Turkish invasion, refusing to denounce their NATO allies. This means that the Rojava and the YPG are stuck in the middle of an extremely uncomfortable situation, in which they are being hunted by every single imperialist regime force present in Syria. The Russians hate them because they are backed by the US. The Turks hate them because they are Turkish and they hate the Kurds. And the US allow the Turkish to kill them because they are both NATO allies. ISIS, of course, hate them because they are Neanderthals who haven't evolved past the 7th century. Turkey's insistence that the YPG, who defend the autonomous libertarian and feminist region of Rojava, are harbouring ISIS is so detached from reality, is quite frankly obscene. Especially coming from Turkey, a burgeoning Islamist and anti-secular state led by Erdogan, a man who denies the Armenian genocide, has voiced his admiration for Nazi Germany, and in its earliest stages provided covert logistical support for ISIS in an attempt to wipe all Kurds off the map. The YPG are fundamentally the anti-ISIS. Accusing them of being akin to Daesh is like accusing Nelson Mandela of being a white supremacist. The Democratic Federation of Northern Syria, commonly known as the Rojava, is a de facto autonomous region in northern Syria. A secular and polyethnic region, Rojava is built on the principles of democratic confederalism, democratic socialism, gender equality, and ecological sustainability. They are defended by the YPG, referred to as People's Protection Unit. The constitution of Rojava is an explicit affirmation of minority rights and gender equality. The constitution directly forbids any form of violence or invasion of sovereign peoples or nations, which of course completely contradicts Turkish insistence that they are terrorists or in any way allied with ISIS. They stake no claim whatsoever over a federal Syria nor over Turkey. The YPG, or the People's Protection Units, were merely set up to defend the three regions of northern Syria in which their people belong: the Afrin region, the Jazeera region, and the Euphrates region. Their politics are inspired by the later years of the Kurdish intellectual Abdullah Öcalan, who abandoned traditional Marxist philosophy in favour of libertarian or anarchist left thought. Abdullah Öcalan was in turn inspired by the anarchist intellectual Murray Bookchin, who hails from New York. These two presumably initially bonded through a mutual love of thick moustaches straight out of Magnum PI. They went on to both become leading intellectuals in the promotion of democratic confederalism, a decentralised leftist structure built on the principles of direct democracy and council planning of political decision. This is what inspired the Rojava political system of bottom-up direct democratic decisions. Governance takes place through local Athenian-style face-to-face councils, making parliamentary or congressional representatives completely superfluous, as the everyday population are able to assert their beliefs and wishes through face-to-face council decision-making processes. Assemblies have to be 50-50 between both genders, and they have to include participants from every single ethnic group who make up the governorate. A huge departure from the traditional Western-backed governance of Middle Eastern countries, which normally consist of religious or ethnic nationalism. Most of the Western media attention on Rojava is so far focused on the girl power slant, owing to the fact that they have a lot of female fighters in the People's Protection Unit. The female unit is the YPJ, as opposed to the YPG, which is the male unit. These guys are absolutely obsessed with acronyms. They've taken up about two-thirds of the world's acronym reserves. String together any three letters and you'll probably end up referencing an anti-ISIS militia who convene every Thursday in a tea room in Kobani. There have been several documentaries titled things like The Female Fighters of Kurdistan, which are borderline pervy in the sense that they just string together a load of the most attractive fighters they can find. Sort of like a Victoria's Secret photo shoot, except the models in question are currently under heavy mortar fire by an Islamist death cult. However, I haven't seen in particular any Western media attention towards the fact that the US's NATO allies are blowing the shit out of their also ostensible allies, the Kurds. This implies that America are happy for the Kurds to effectively be used and then discarded once they're surplus to requirements. As long as the Kurds are fighting ISIS or holding their own against Assad, the US are more than happy to have their backs and give them all the weapons and training they may need. However, when they're under attack from their northern neighbours, who happen to be the US's allies in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, suddenly they get very quiet on the matter and won't stand up for the Kurds whatsoever. This demonstrably ruinous and exploitative policy of pitting allies against enemies, enemies against allies, and even allies against allies in the Middle East, in order to generally weaken any potential rivals in the region, is straight out of the Henry Kissinger realpolitik textbook. The idea that any nation, militia, or fucking book club can be weaponized and used as a tool of upheaval against your enemies began with Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State in 1973, and has continued up to modern-day Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and now Rex Tillerson. This style of foreign relations is always detrimental to inherently peaceful and inward-looking communities such as the Rojava. The Rojava and the YPG are only interested in defending their homeland. Unfortunately for the US, this mindset is ultimately pretty useless, as they won't kill who they want them to kill. Peaceful and democratic movements in the Middle East are completely benign and don't serve the US interest of carving up the region and removing dictators who are no longer answering to the US's every whim. It's because of this that Erdogan's authoritarian Turkish state will undoubtedly succeed in destroying the Kurds south of their border. After this, the US will just dust off their shoulder and move on to arming a presumably much more radical and militant group. If the US actually stood true to what they claim their foreign policy promotes, democracy, egalitarianism, ethnic minority rights, the Rojava would undoubtedly sit as head of the table in diplomatically mapping out a new and better Middle East. In reality, however, the US pick and choose winners and losers based purely on geopolitical capital, as well as how best they serve US interests, which almost always involve the complete serfdom of sovereign Middle Eastern citizens to the whims of large American oil and gas corporations. Because the Rojava or the YPG don't fit any of this criteria, Turkey is simply allowed to invade without anything more than a few gasps from the international community. And in a year's time, Western media will be asking questions about what happened to all the democratic and liberal forces inside Syria. The answer, of course, is that we keep destroying them or simply allowing them to be destroyed.
This is Kamal Lamani, a.k.a. Kamal Supreme. I'm in Brooklyn, Brooklyn, Medina, with my man Jonathan, his daughter Jasmine, my cousin Will, my wife Diane, my baby Hassan, and we are newblackmusic.net. And the name of this poem I'm about to do is called The N-Word. Historically, we're forgetting where we came from and what the black man and woman do in America transmits all over the world and possibly the universe. But people are getting the wrong interpretation of our culture, history, and words such as the N-word. So they're using it lightly. Now, if we're going to use it, I don't think it should be as a term of endearment. Maybe dramatically, like I'm doing in performance poetry, you know, or maybe in a drama to show forth our history and bring forth meaning. But it shouldn't be something that anybody can toss off their list, because we can't call Jews certain names because we'll be anti-Semitic, and we can't call Hispanics certain names because we'll be anti-them. So we can't call white people certain names. So why should we allow people to call us nigger? Why should we call ourselves nigger as a term of endearment? You know, I read articles that there's a store in Africa called Nigger, and they say they got that from Puff, and they think there's nothing wrong with nigger. They just was listening to this hip-hop, and that nigger's a good thing over there, you know? And, you know, I got white boys calling each other nigger, calling black people nigger, Spanish calling black nigger. Gotta stop. Everybody got to get back into the history, for real. We're glorious people, but we're forgetting our history. We're here for a reason. God only let us come here because he know we can handle it. So let's handle it, and let's rise above it, and let's rule again. Rule righteously. What's up, my nigga? With the term of the demon that he gave, I paused and looked around like, you talking to me? Because to me, a nigga is a modern-day slave. See, niggas is living in America with one foot in a death grave. But because you getting paid, nigga, you think you got it made, nigga. You think you got power because you can pull a trigger, nigga, and kill your brothers and sisters, nigga. Because you are irate and you can show and prove that you hate a nigga. My father used to say the black man is a coward. Because he want to act like a man. While real men are handling the affairs of the world. Real men are trading diamonds, copper, gold, oil, steel, and uranium. Real men are thinking long range and manipulating interest rates in the stock exchange. While niggas is playing games. Niggas is playing games like, who shot ya? Niggas is playing games like, who's darker? And who look like Beyonce? And who look like Miss Parker? Who got the baddest prefabricated MTV crib? Who got the baddest ass, girl? What you mean? You should be playing hopscotch, girl. You only 13. And who's pimping A-Ride? Nigga, do you know what pimp means? Nigga, you being pimped by the establishment as a political machine. Niggas are being pimped by immigrant merchants in our hoods. We got Arabs selling us swine, blunts, and cancer sticks. Koreans selling us hip-hop clothes. And international niggas selling us what we put up in our nose. Parasites. You ask them, yo, why you buy from Parasites? They be like, shh. It's all good, dog. It's all gravy. Niggas is being pimped by the Army, Air Force, Marines, and Navy. Niggas are being pimped by the prison industrial complex. And you think niggas pimping just got to do with money, cash, hoes, and sex. Niggas need to study lessons that Elijah, Malcolm Lewis, Clarence, and them gave. Maybe niggas will realize that a nigga is a modern day slave. Nigga.
Hi, this is Annie from Avoir Simone. You're listening to a Creative Commons licensed podcast.
This is APNS Public Radio.
In the heat of the night, hear the bump of the ball on the floor of the court, on the sides of the hall. He's cornbread.
Cornbread.
He's cornbread.
Cornbread.
American International presents Cornbread Earl and Me, the story of a young man with a talent.
Hey, superstar.
And a dream.
It's the first boy from this neighborhood to make something out of himself.
Cornbread.
Like Sounder, it's a story of people who never lose their dignity or their pride.
Take your hands off him.
Shut up.
I will not shut up.
Like Claudine, it's a story of family life full of love and laughter.
This is a dining room, not a gym.
Oh, mama.
Don't you owe mama me.
Like no other movie, Cornbread Earl and Me will touch you.
I'm gonna miss that boy.
And move you.
Oh, police!
And perhaps even shatter you. Cornbread Earl and Me, rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
Decree issued by the non-elected president of that country, Michel Temer, ordered the army to invade the streets of Rio de Janeiro in a desperate attempt to control the violence by narcotic bands and other forms of organized crime. Since this past Monday, even before the decision was approved by Congress, some 3,000 soldiers, supported by troops from the Army, Navy, and Air Force, occupied the main points of this city on the southeastern shore of the Atlantic coast. Rio de Janeiro has become one of the most violent cities in Brazil, and in 2017 alone there were 16 shootings per day with 6,700 fatalities, including 10 children and 100 policemen. The situation became unmanageable for the local police, and this fact helped Temer to order military intervention of the city that will continue until at least the end of this year, a decision that has sparked deep concern among Brazilian public opinion. The non-elected Brazilian president claims that the situation had overcome the possibilities of the local authorities and that the only way to return to normalcy was the application of military force, something that has sparked fears of widespread repression. The local Rio de Janeiro population is now in the middle of a gunfight between two powerfully armed combatants. Those fears are well-founded, since the armies in those countries are not trained for an activity that calls for a deep knowledge of the law and full respect for the individual and constitutional rights of the population at large. They may know a lot about military strategy and tactics dealing with their primary goal, which is to safeguard the integrity of the Brazilian national sovereignty, but most certainly not to keep law and order on the streets. Worse still, according to the non-elected Brazilian president, the Rio police will be placed under the jurisdiction of the military command. Previous similar experiences in other countries have not been successful. In Mexico, for instance, the use of the army against drug trafficking has unleashed a war with a temporary balance of tens of thousands of fatalities and unexplained disappearances. It must be stressed that the situation of violence in Rio de Janeiro is the result of the incapacity of the authorities, corruption, and of the neoliberal policies introduced by the current illegal regime that has devoted itself to dismantling the social benefit programs introduced by the three previous administrations of the Brazilian Workers' Party. Violence is a daughter of poverty, and Mr. Temer is grossly mistaken if he thinks that he will defeat it with the application of more violence, while at the same time he tightens the noose on the necks of millions of Brazilians that have watched as their social and economic gains of the previous years have just evaporated through the actions of the current illegal authorities. The illegal Brazilian president would do well in recalling that when the people at large loses everything, they usually lose their fear. And this, friends, has been Radio Havana Cuba's editorial comment for today. In Havana, I am Alberto de Pérez.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to do. They ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
An abyss.
After millions of dollars in treatment, the women now say the doctors were wrong.
It stopped because I stopped following Dr. Braun's orders.
Tonight on Frontline, the search for Satan.
Funding for Frontline is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by annual financial support from viewers like you. This is Frontline.
About you. When I look back, I can't believe it ever happened to me.
You could join therapy.
Mary S. spent 3 years in psychiatric wards, diagnosed as a victim of satanic ritual abuse.
You and Bobby ruined it! Ah!
I was told that I was raised in a satanic cult. And when you're raised in a satanic cult, you abuse people, even the people that you love.
Everybody around you is in the cult. You don't know what it is to be a person. But you don't even know that I'm smart enough to love your daughter and get her out of the cult.
It was like going deeper and deeper and deeper into an abyss. There was no end. There was, it was like a bottomless pit of horrors. I really believed that I would either end up in a psych unit for the rest of my life, or that when my insurance ran out, that I would live underneath a bridge as a bag woman.
Mary's journey, paid for by her insurance company, took her into one of the most controversial areas in modern psychiatry. It began 6 years ago when Mary lived with her husband Joe and her 8-year-old son Ryan in the suburbs of Chicago. He worked in telecommunications. She was a school teacher.
They were the typical loving family.
Meredith Schreiner and her husband were close friends with Joe and Mary.
They were very good friends as well as lovers, and they were very close. They had a good relationship. She also had a wonderful relationship with her child. Mary was a great mom with Ryan. Just a great mom, had tons of patience.
In 1988, Mary fell into a deep depression.
I started having panic attacks, not being able to eat, losing a lot of weight, not being able to sit still, not being able to concentrate. So I went in. I went to a psychiatrist to get medication.
She found a counselor that was recommended by a friend and went to her. And within a few months, she kept getting worse. Anxiety attacks were very bad.
Because I had seizures and blackouts, my therapist felt that I might be suffering from dissociative disorders. And so I went for an evaluation at the best hospital in Chicago with the leading experts in the field.
The hospital was Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's in Chicago, a renowned teaching hospital with a unit specializing in treating the dissociative disorder known as multiple personality disorder. There, Mary met with Dr. Roberta Sachs.
Within the first 5 minutes, I was in her office. She diagnosed me as polyfragmented multiple. Multiplicity was something that we knew nothing about. And so she described multiplicity as taking a vase and dropping it on a cement floor. And that's what had happened to my personality. It had shattered into that many pieces. And that her job as a therapist was to glue those pieces back together into a whole.
Mary was 38 by then. Her life had not been easy. Growing up, she had a learning disability. When she was 19, she was brutally date raped, became pregnant, and gave the child up for adoption. After her marriage and the birth of her son, she underwent a hysterectomy and developed seizures. Her husband was a recovering alcoholic. Finally, shortly before the onset of her depression, she was attacked in a hallway at the school where she taught. Still, Mary says, her therapist, who had attended a seminar on satanic cult abuse, thought that that might be another explanation for her depression. Mary wondered. She went to church.
It is my opinion that history will mark April of 1989 as the month when Americans were forced to pull their heads out of the sand.
There's a very large church in our area. And during the time that Mary was trying to find herself through counseling and find out why she was having anxiety attacks, they were having a series on cults in this church. A series meaning 8-9 weeks of sermons on that.
In April of 1989, Satanism came out of the closet for everyone to see it in all of its ugliness. The Satan worshippers that pose the greatest threat to our society are the secret splinter groups. Scores of clandestine groups are meeting right here in our neighborhood, and the amount of activity is on the rapid increase. Several churches in our immediate area have been broken into recently.
Even though it was bizarre, it seemed to be an answer for her as to why she was anxious and why she was scared and why she was nervous.
Don't think that this satanic activity isn't going on in our community, because it is. In fact, a short...
It was not a new idea. 10 years before, the bestseller, Michelle Remembers, told the story of a young woman who had traced the source of her unhappiness to repressed memories of being satanically abused by her family. Soon, newspapers and magazines were full of stories of abuse at the hands of satanic cults. Stories involving cannibalism, human sacrifice, blood rituals. The abuse was so terrible, some therapists said, that it caused children to develop multiple personalities as a defense against the pain. Then television joined in.
Magazine 2020.
The Geraldo Rivera Special.
By 1988, when Geraldo Rivera's highly rated special on Satanism was broadcast, satanic ritual abuse was considered one of the leading causes of multiple personality disorder, or MPD.
But we are certain that Satanism exists. To some, it's a religion. To others, it's the practice of evil in the devil's name.
Geraldo invited experts in MPD who firmly believed that many of their patients were survivors of satanic cults.
Here in Chicago, a group of well-known therapists from all over the country had the courage to share horror stories.
We're talking about people in some cases who are coming to us as patients who were raised in satanic cults from the time they were born.
I have letters in my file from over 40 states in the United States and several provinces of Canada, and one from England, with very similar data.
If just a tiny bit of it is true, it's appalling, and there's a need for somebody to do something.
Part of the power of the cult, both with the individual and with the others around it, is its ability to induce fear.
Dr. Bennett Braun became a leading spokesman on the connection between MPD and ritual abuse.
It needs to be done. It needs to be looked at.
It was to Dr. Braun and his colleague Roberta Sachs of Chicago that Mary had turned for diagnosis and treatment. Mary's reasons for admission, according to her hospital records, read, "Patient is a victim of satanic ritualistic abuse. Diagnosis of MPD." Mary's vague fears of having been abused in a cult now received the stamp of professional certainty. She was surprised to discover, she said, that her doctors seemed to know more about her family's history than she did.
Roberta Sachs came in and told me that victims throughout the country had identified me as the fifth generation cult, that we were high up in the cult, that we were cult royalty.
Who's we?
My family, my parents, my sisters, and I.
Once hospitalized, Mary began regular therapy sessions with Dr. Braun and Roberta or Bobby Sachs.
Most of the sessions were about memory. And many of the sessions were with my husband, Joe. He would come to the sessions, and the two of us would sit down, and they would ask questions about, you know, who we knew from church, who was in the people in the school district, what I knew about their personal life, who we socialized with, trying to get more and more information about the cult. And
but this is an, is this a treatment or was this an investigation?
It felt like an investigation, and in fact, oftentimes I would say to Bobby, all you want is information from me. And she'd say, no, you know, we're concerned at getting that for you to get better. But if I didn't have any information, they didn't have any time for me, especially Dr. Braun.
Dr. Braun prescribed the medication. He put Mary on a variety of medications, among them Halcyon, Clonopin, Xanax, Prozac, and on experimentally high doses of the heart medication Inderol. Heavily medicated, Mary says she lived in fear.
They told me that I had already been programmed that if I divulged the secrets from the cult, that I would self-destruct. And that my programming had just been turned on at age 39.
How did they know that?
Because they were the experts. They were experts. They said, we've been studying this for 15 years. We've done research. You know, this phenomena is happening all over the world. We're the experts. We've written books. We give lectures. People come to our hospital. Other doctors come to our hospital and are trained by us because we are the experts.
In fact, Mary's doctors were considered leading experts in their field. In November of 1994, Dr. Braun was honored at the annual conference of the International Society for the Study of Multiple Personality and Dissociation.
We all owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Dr. Braun.
Most of the big names in the field were there. Gloria Steinem was keynote speaker and guest of honor.
And the burden for keeping all of this afloat was Dr. Braun's absolutely far beyond the contribution of anybody else in the field of the society.
I want to assure everybody that Rush intends to continue its commitment to ongoing professional education in the field of dissociation. We are currently...
It was because of her doctor's reputations, Mary says, that she persevered in her treatment, despite her fears and her growing misgivings.
I had doubts all along the way. My journal is just full of statements, you know, this can't be true, this is a nightmare, I've made this up. I mean, my whole life, my whole world had been turned upside down at that point. Here, you know, I go from being this teacher and having a normal life and doing normal things to a cult royalty.
In an educational video, Dr. Sachs explained,
very few patients who have been ritually abused come in and say, I've been ritually abused, you know, and I've been through this torture and that torture, and I've been pregnant this many times and aborted this many times and forced to participate in cannibalism and on and on and on. On the contrary, these people do everything they can to deny the existence of that.
We're trying to help.
Dr. Sachs explained in her records what was wrong with Mary. Mary had an estimated 15 developed child alters, some with twins, and a system with 7 cult alters, but was unaware of their existence. Mary was encouraged to cut off contact with most family members and friends outside the hospital. Meredith had not seen her friend in months.
She was lost to us totally. We had no idea where she was.
She contacted Mary's husband, Joe.
I asked if we could visit her, and he said no. And I said, well, how about if I can call her, send her a card, whatever. He said, no, you may have no contact with her at all. None of her friends could have contact. We couldn't talk to her. She couldn't talk to us. This was the doctor's orders, and that's the way it was going to be.
Mary was cut off.
I had no way to test my reality. There were a lot of nurses and things that I went to and I said, you know, is this reality? And they all reinforced, yes, it was, you know, that I was really in the best of care and that, you know, this was such a new field. And we were always being told we were the pioneers. We were on the cutting edge of this field, and that what they were doing with us would shape the treatment of MPDs in future generations.
Multiple personality disorder, we've all seen it dramatized on television.
Even though it was controversial, Dr. Braun's work was considered to be on the cutting edge of treatment for MPD.
Yet there's just one facility devoted solely to its treatment. And as Channel 5's Rick Salinger reports, it's here in Chicago. Rick?
Ron and Carol, it's located in that canyon of condominiums along Sheridan Road north of Hollywood. Dr. Bennett Braun founded the Dissociative Disorders Unit 1 year ago as part of Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center. Meet Pat.
I'm 32. I'm married. I have two children.
By outward appearances, she is normal. But inside are dozens of different people. Where would Pat be without this unit?
I wouldn't be alive. Chances are my children and husband wouldn't be alive either.
Pat Burgess was one of the first patients on the unit in 1986. She arrived after having been in a depression for 3 years, following the difficult birth of her second son. When a social worker diagnosed her with MPD, she sought help at Rush.
These were the experts. They were in a very well-respected teaching institution. I turned to that teaching institution for state-of-the-art medical care, cutting-edge medical care. I didn't turn to them for fringe therapy, some goofy, controversial crap.
What do you hear her say?
That the hurting is over.
Dr. Braun often treated me like his star patient. I would have to teach other residents and doctors and media people about multiple personality disorder.
Who's there?
Sarah.
How old are you, Sarah?
4 or 5.
I was supposed to switch personalities for the camera.
Who's this?
Karen.
Karen, you don't seem too happy.
I'm not.
Dr. Braun and I kind of rehearsed that a few times to make sure that it looked believable for the interviewer. I was supposed to talk about how, if it wasn't for Dr. Braun, I wouldn't be alive.
Where would Pat be without this unit?
I wouldn't be alive.
Patty says that Dr. Braun both pushed her to remember things that didn't occur and then believed her stories. After a year in the hospital, Patty traced the satanic history of her family back to the 17th century.
Satanic cult practices have been passed down through the paternal side of the family.
Dr. Braun asked me to write up something to do a presentation at his conference. It was supposed to be one of my alter personalities giving a history about the cult.
The satanic activity has been genealogically traced to a southern Slavic region of Europe during the Middle Evil Ages, when her forebears were the supreme monarchs of the blood royal.
I believe that I was a satanic high priestess, that I was controlling a satanic cult in a 9-state region.
Revealed was the history of
I took it deadly serious.
Satanic worship, torturous human sacrifice, cannibalism, and
I think all reality and fantasy just blended together.
Before hospitals,
I was drugged, I was hypnotized, and I was mentally ill.
She also knew nothing of the history.
But I was told that, you know, until I hit bottom, until I dug all of this stuff out, I would never get better, and I would never have a chance for any kind of a future for my children.
Mary says she, too, was told she had to persevere in her treatment for the sake of her son.
I was told that I was the only one in 5 generations who was given the insight to break this cycle, and if I wanted my son to live and not become, you know, a cultist or to die, then I was responsible for his life.
A turning point in Mary's treatment came when Dr. Sachs asked her to attend a consultation with one of the most important experts in cult programming techniques, Dr. Corey Hammond, professor of medicine at the University of Utah.
And some of it isn't very
Dr. Hammond lectured often on the origins and practices of the cult.
Use a very, very systematic brainwashing that comes out of experimentation from Nazi doctors and experimentation in the intelligence community with mind control research and involves medical technology and is very, very sophisticated. And is systematic.
In one of his lectures, not available to the public, Hammond described his theories about the origins of satanic cult programming, starting with a Jewish collaborator in the Nazi death camps. His name was Greenbaum, alias Dr. Green.
Some of the people then doing the mind control research were Satanists, the Nazi doctors, and they have used all the technology. And in fact, the kid who came over, whose name was Greenbaum, changed his name and Americanized it to Green, and got an MD in the state of New York and became known as Dr. Green. And he's at the center of this process and is still around. He's around mid-60s and still alive.
According to Dr. Hammond, Dr. Green developed a secret code based on the Greek alphabet, which the cult used to program its members. Examples: Alpha represented general programming. Beta was sexual programming. Delta was the program for killing. Gamma was the one that therapists should look out for. It was a deception program, teaching misinformation and trickery. Dr. Hammond evaluated Mary.
Is there any part of Mary who knows anything about Alpha, Beta, Delta, or Theta?
He hypnotized me and put me in trance, and then he asked me about the Greek alphabet and asked me to name any of the Greek letters of the alphabet that I knew, and I named a few. And then he asked me for the gamma erasure code, and I didn't know what he was talking about.
Mary remembers being told that her gamma program was still active. That meant she was still loyal to the cult and possibly a danger to the staff and other patients.
But I believe that quite a few of them that we're treating are still involved in cults, and that we should not be treating them if they are. And that's a cruel, terrible thing to say. And that it is a danger to them and a danger to us.
Mary says that she was told that besides being a cult plant and a spy, she was now strongly suspected of having ritually abused and programmed her son. He had to be evaluated. She had to be deprogrammed. Dr. Sachs recommended that the work be done in Houston by her colleague, Dr. Judith Peterson.
Hi, Judy.
Hi.
It's good to see you today.
The two therapists referred patients to each other and had collaborated on several training programs.
What you're about to see is a role play of an abreaction that
Peterson, a licensed psychologist and PhD, was clinical director of a special unit at Spring Shadows Glen, a private psychiatric hospital in Houston, Texas. A small building surrounded by trees, the hospital was nicknamed Club Med by its patients. Mary would stay there for 2 years. Some of her therapy sessions were taped. In this session, Dr. Peterson is to Mary's right.
Can somebody come out? Can you come all the way out?
By the time I got down to Houston, they didn't care what had happened to me. I was identified as a perpetrator and treated as a perpetrator.
Come on out. She knows she's wrong. The parts come all the way out. They're in charge of the accident they're responsible for.
They told me that there was someone, some cult alter, deep within my system that knew the plan about killing my husband and my son. And that all I needed to do was to let that altar surface.
By then, Mary says, she believed it all and tried hard to provide some useful information.
They would say, you know, let them come up, bring them up. Let the real cult loyal altars come up and give this plan.
You heard that. What else? What else? What else is dangerous to you? What's the plan? What's the plan? Who's gonna kill John? Who's got the job? Who'd you get the job to?
I was told that I would go to prison because they knew that I had killed people. and that I had abused these children, and I was part of this international network.
Mary's friends had no idea what had happened to her.
I was very concerned at that time that maybe she was dead. I knew she'd call. We were close friends. I knew she would call. Some way, somehow, she would call if she could. And by that point, I was really beginning to doubt what was going on with her and with Joe. And I was just very scared.
And stop hurting people and stop abusing people. That's what it means. Don't worry about feeling guilty. Just stop being a perpetrator.
Mary's husband, Joe, who was working with her doctors, had been persuaded that his wife was indeed in a cult that was intent on killing him, and that Mary's alter personalities had abused their son.
He's been so screwed up by the cult that he has to have professional help to know what it is to be a little boy. With program after program, it's got him so confused, and he doesn't know what it means to be a normal boy, and he's working hard to find out what it is.
Ryan was admitted to the same hospital as his mother, where he was being evaluated for multiple personality disorder and cult abuse. Although he stayed on the unit right next door to her, mother and son were kept apart. Sally McDonald was a nurse on the children's ward.
I knew Ryan as a patient on the children's unit, and he came in as a very normal little boy who was full of joy, full of activity, very normal, talented little kid.
Ryan was one of several children at Spring Shadows who were diagnosed with multiple personality disorder as a result of ritual abuse.
These children came into the hospital as really stable, well-functioning kids. Most of them were admitted with absolutely no idea of why they were there. An example of that is a 13-year-old who was admitted on her 13th birthday. And she was told that that was the date that she would be initiated into a satanic cult, and that they, by admitting her to the hospital, they were protecting her.
This nurse asked not to be identified.
What I saw are children being admitted with very normal behaviors, being allegedly involved in a cult, not knowing anything about the cult, and then slowly over time being told about that they had parts and they had to look within themselves to find these parts of them. And there was a lot of pressure on them. They went into therapy sessions to identify these parts of them, which eventually became alters, which eventually had names and became part of the multiple personality.
Was she supposedly a member of a cult?
She reported that.
Dr. Peterson supervised the treatment of nearly all the MPD patients in the hospital. Eventually, most of her treatment techniques would be questioned. Among them, her alleged practice of restraining patients at 9 points on their body for hours and sometimes days.
Restraints are a very serious form of treatment to protect a patient, and yet these patients were often kept in restraints for long periods of time, sometimes to satisfy information gathering of Dr. Peterson. She sought to bring out different alters while this patient was tied down. And unless these patients produced these alters, those patients stayed in restraints for 8-16 hours at a time.
The nursing staff was torn and dismayed.
We were truly in the middle of an ethical dilemma. There was a lot of hostility from the psychologist and the psychiatrist. There was also a lot of discussion about the nurses, that the reason there was such a conflict was because the nurses just couldn't, quote, understand what was going on. So the belief was if they just educated us more, we would understand everything.
Dr. Peterson wrote in a letter to the administrator of the hospital, "No education can occur with nurses who still live in the dark ages."
It became very clear to the nurses that if we objected, there would be a reprisal. And that reprisal would be a transfer off the unit, a demotion, in some cases an actual termination. And that created a very chilling effect. People were afraid to object, and yet they knew. These nurses knew they had to object because they feared violating their Nurse Practice Act.
I didn't feel that I could really live with myself and the kinds of things that I was seeing happen to these children. I felt like these children were being robbed of their childhood.
Dr. Peterson filed a child abuse report against Mary with the Department of Child and Family Services in Illinois, citing that Mary had reported electroshocking her son and abusing him in different places around the country. As for Ryan, Dr. Peterson wrote, "Ryan is felt to be a youngster who is highly programmed as a structured, polyfragmented MPD, who has programs for suicide, homicide, and return to the cult." Ryan was 10 years old at the time.
I didn't see him the last few days before he left, but I recently found out that after he'd left, he had gone on to a facility for multiple personalities, and that was very disheartening to me to hear that story. I was very shocked that I thought he had left the hospital because he was one of the lucky ones that had escaped.
The facility Dr. Peterson referred Ryan to was back in Chicago, next door to the Rush Hospital complex where his mother had first been hospitalized. Ryan was not the only child to be treated for multiple personality disorder and cult-related abuse. Patty Burgess's two sons, Mikey and John, had spent almost 3 years under Dr. Braun's care at Rush.
The children were put in the hospital because I was told that multiple personality disorder had a genetic predisposition to it and that the children would definitely develop multiple personality disorder, and by having them in a teaching hospital, they could watch this develop and catch it and treat the children right away for it.
John was hospitalized first at the age of 5 and was quickly diagnosed with multiple personality disorder.
Now you're all in this little Bible. Wasn't that funny, Bob?
Maureen Gannon was the state-required teacher on the children's ward. She spent several hours with John every day.
They said John was MPD.
Right. They said John was in a multiple personality, that he had a multiple personality disorder.
Did you see that?
No, I did not see that. But I felt that that was a lack of my own training. I wasn't trained as a psychiatrist, and when they would talk about the various personalities and the subtle differences of them, I did not see those.
Now, you have to go in your wheelchair.
I couldn't have told you the difference. I could not have pointed out and said this was this personality and this was that personality at any time.
He seemed the same, basically, to you.
Seemed like a kid.
Patty's younger son, Mikey, was hospitalized 7 months after his brother.
Dr. Braun became very concerned about the first Halloween coming up, 1986. And he told us that unless Mikey was in the hospital, he was in mortal danger.
Mikey was then admitted to the hospital on an emergency basis. He was 4 years old. Patty and her children, who were housed in different parts of the hospital, got together in therapy sessions. Patty remembers them as the sticker sessions.
I was supposed to do everything that I could do to encourage and support the children in the telling of these yucky secrets. And the more yucky secrets they were able to tell, the more stickers they got for that day. So the kids were real motivated to do this as well.
Excerpts from the child psychiatrist's notes. John talked about being threatened that someone in his family would be killed if he didn't obey orders. Two stickers. And another. John related an incident where a black woman was seized by the cult and choked to death. Afterwards, victim was barbecued. Three stickers. In this California trial, where Dr. Braun testified as an expert witness, he used an example from one of John's sticker sessions to stress the validity of satanic abuse of children.
But I had one child who was just 5 years old talk to me about what it's like to stick a knife in somebody's abdomen and pull it down, and how the intestines pop out. I mean, they just blow out. And what it smells like.
The discussion that day was surrounding John cutting open this man's stomach. And Dr. Braun was pumping John for some details about how did this happen? What was it like? And John said how he took this knife and he stuck it in this man, and how he cut it and cut the man, and how his stomach popped open, and how it smelled terrible.
In the description of that, having done surgery myself, I know what it's like to open the belly. And if the anesthesia isn't done right and the muscle relaxing isn't done right, that's exactly what happens. The bowels come right out through the wound. And this, here's a five-year-old that can describe to me something I know something about and have it perfectly as far as I'm concerned.
The kids went back to the unit. They got their stickers that day, and John got extra stickers because he did such a good story here. And I told Dr. Braun, I said, wait a minute. You know, hearing him, I know that's not real. Because I know that's a scene from a Star Wars movie.
Ben.
Where Luke Skywalker cuts open this beast he was riding, and all the guts spill out, and it smells really terrible.
Dagobah's system. I thought they smelled bad on the outside.
And when I heard John tell it, I knew he was telling me the story from the movie. But Dr. Braun wouldn't believe it.
Where does a five-year-old learn about this? Not many five-year-olds go in operating rooms.
Of all the members of the Burgess family, only the boy's father, Michael, was not thought to have been involved in the cult.
What did you make of it all?
Well, as far as I can, you know, determine from you know, what Patty had said and what the doctors had said, the boys were supposed to be being trained by Patty to participate in cult activities and then at some future date take over, a leadership role in this cult.
And when did they first get into the cult?
Shortly after birth, they were supposedly been trained as small infants to do these kinds of satanic rituals, to do the murders, to kill other children. And they were supposed to have been trained to do all that.
But how could that have happened if you didn't know about it?
I that's what had me confused. As things started getting into a regular routine of all the, every week, every day, there was a new memory coming up. You know, after my initial, shock and horror and really fear, because I was afraid for my family's life, it became more and more difficult to believe all the stuff that happened.
Did you ever ask Dr. Braun where the bodies were, why there was no evidence, why?
Well, of course, those were the questions. Why aren't you doing something about this? How come the police aren't being involved in this? And the answer, of course, was that they were gathering evidence to be able to crack into this very secretive and dangerous cult, and that people had, gone into it undercover and had been killed or had been actually drawn into the cult themselves. And that they were gathering evidence so that they could do something about it. And that the reason why it was never uncovered was because these people ate the evidence so that there wasn't any evidence. And that there were doctors involved with this so that there were cover-ups as far as, medical findings and things. So there were always answers for every question that everybody had, that seemed reasonable.
The Burgess children were hospitalized for almost 3 years.
Our five-year-old John, who went in,
was there for 39 months. And Mikey was brought into the hospital at 4 years old, and he was kept on a children's psychiatric unit for 32 months. From the time I entered the hospital until we got the children out of the hospital by court order, it was 1,200 days.
And how much money?
We each had a $1 million insurance policy that was almost completely topped out. So we're looking at $3 million.
This is a partial list of the Burgess family's hospital bills. Their bill for medication alone was in the tens of thousands of dollars. Hospital room and board was well over $1 million. Mary's hospital bills also amounted to millions of dollars.
The rough estimate of just adding up what hospital bills we do have and therapy bills that we do have, it's over $2.5 million.
Did you pay it?
My insurance company paid out that amount of money.
The cost of Mary's care at Spring Shadows Glen averaged $1,200 a day. According to the staff, this was not unusual.
The unit was very profitable because it was billed at an intensive care rate rather than the normal rate on another unit. And these patients stayed for long periods of time.
Dr. Jack Leggett is a clinical psychologist who used to review mental health claims for insurance companies around the country. Beginning in the late 1980s, he noticed a startling pattern in the claims involving MPD patients. Most of them had generous insurance policies.
The focus was generally on patients with very rich benefits plans, and I would find in some cases that large numbers of people from single employers with those types of plans would suddenly be presenting with this diagnosis. An incidence of multiple personality way beyond anything reasonable that could be expected for a given population of individuals. So there was a targeting of the richer benefits plans.
Dr. Leggett discovered that questioning the bills of MPD patients could have unpleasant consequences.
I was met with the most hostile responses that I came across in all the years I'd done any kind of case management or clinical supervision, beginning with discounting the credibility of myself and the board-certified experienced psychiatrists and psychologists that I used, extending on to rather strange suggestions at times that I might be in somehow related to these satanic cults or the organizations I worked for.
Hospital staff also felt threatened.
That if you resisted the psychologist and the psychiatrist, you might be labeled as one of the cult. And that happened to some people, that they were considered, quote, cult members. And so you never quite knew when you might get labeled for that, too. It's kind of like a witch hunt.
According to Dr. Leggett, a lot of money was being spent while the patients were not getting any better.
There's sort of a cliche, you have to get worse before you get better. The problem was people got worse without getting better.
Mary was getting much worse.
It was a snake pit. It was like hell. I'm sure that I would die there sooner or later, and probably sooner. Somehow, I had just gotten lost, and no one out there will even know that I'm gone.
Mary had been in Houston for 2 years when her insurance company began to push for a change in status. She was to be moved permanently to a nursing home. Somehow, she says, she gathered enough strength to resist.
I wasn't going. I refused to go. I decided that
I had nothing to lose. I had lost everything. Everything. I decided I just wanted to leave and take my chances.
According to Mary, the hospital agreed to release her on the condition that she get herself a sophisticated security system to protect her from the cult, and that she find a therapist on the outside.
The doctor that I was released to, I continued to go to therapy with him, and it wasn't very long before he said on my second visit, he said, "Do you like being multiple?" And I said, "No, I hate it. It's awful. You know, I'm really working to integrate all these parts." And he says, "You don't have to be multiple anymore. You can just stop. Just stop. Stop working. Stop thinking about it. We'll just work on getting you physically healthy," because I was in awful, awful physical health. And getting you off this medication, because I had to go through all the withdrawal. And he said, "That's enough. We don't need to work on your personalities. You don't have to be multiple anymore." When I stopped working on it, it dissipated. The memories started to stop. I found out that I could go outside my apartment and I never got shot at. I could go to the grocery store. I never got poisoned. I could make telephone calls. I wasn't being taped. Nothing was happening.
It stopped because I stopped following Dr. Braun's orders. I stopped taking the medication and I stopped being involved in the hypnosis. And when my head started to clear after detoxing off of all of that medicine, and my critical thinking skills started to return, the switching stopped. All these goofy things that were going on weren't happening anymore. And I was able to finally take a look at this and say, you know, wait a minute, where are all these bodies? Where are all these people that are supposed to be involved in this cult?
It took months and a court order to get the hospital to release Patty's two sons, who, the child psychiatrist claimed, needed long-term institutionalization. Today, John is 15 and Mikey 13.
Their young boys are starting to go through puberty. You know, how's this going to affect them?
John now is just mainstreaming into a regular junior high school. Mikey still goes to a special school. It's just had a very large impact. It's like there's been a hole in their life, you know, in the normal period of growing up. It's like a large chunk has just taken him and is missing.
Mary was not as lucky as the Burgess family, who ended up together. When she got out of the hospital in Texas and returned home to Chicago, she found her husband and son, who had been in treatment with Dr. Sachs, still believed that she was a member of a cult and intent on killing them. She was still listed with the state of Illinois as a child abuser. Her husband had filed for divorce.
There's a emptiness, there's a void that I'll never be able to fill. And until they stop the therapy with Dr. Sachs, they won't be able to get out of this mindset.
In April of 1995, Mary met with Ryan and Joe at a court-appointed psychiatrist's office. She had not seen her son in 4 years. He was reluctant to talk to her and did not want to see her again. In the end, the psychiatrist, Dr. Alan Ravitz, produced a report for the court. It reads, "I am of the firm opinion that Mary's initial difficulties were not a manifestation of multiple personality disorders secondary to ritualistic abuse. Nevertheless, Joe and Ryan continue to believe the cult abuse explanation. Both of them have placed their trust in mental health professionals who genuinely believe that Mary was both a victim and a perpetrator of this abuse. Continued treatment with the current mental health treatment team, even if issues of abuse are not addressed, covertly perpetuates the belief system that has destroyed this family.
Are they evil? I don't know how anyone could know what is known now and see what it has done to families. My family was not the first family. This had been going on for 15 years. And I now know of stories almost exactly like my story that were 10 years before this, under the same under the same doctors, in the same hospitals. So they knew what was going on, and they still continued to do it. Were they evil? I think that's pretty evil.
The Dissociative Disorders Unit at Spring Shadows Glen Hospital was shut down by the state in 1992.
Well, sometimes I think
Judith Peterson still sees patients in private practice. She is being sued by 10 former patients, including Mary S. Frontline asked Dr. Peterson for an interview, but in an exchange of letters with her lawyer, could not agree to the conditions she requested.
The history of these meetings...
Dr. Bennett Braun and Dr. Roberta Sachs declined to be interviewed for this program. They are still heading their dissociative disorders unit at Rush Hospital in Chicago, which remains one of the leading centers for the treatment of multiple personality disorder. They have been sued by several of their former patients, the Burgess family and Mary S. among them.
We owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Dr. Braun.
After 7 years investigating claims of ritual abuse, the FBI concluded there is little or no evidence for allegations that deal with large-scale baby breeding, human sacrifice, and organized satanic conspiracies. It is up to mental health professionals, not law enforcement, to explain why victims are alleging things that don't seem to have happened.
Dear Frontline,
last night I saw your show.
I discerned a bias.
You can interact with Frontline by sending your comments by fax.
Parents horrifically abused you. It was very, very difficult. And I take more medication in order to cope with that.
Bartha would spend 6 years in and out of mental hospitals. Then, as she started...
Dr. Wilbur, it's getting worse. Who does those drawings?
You do. Well, but you do them as other people. Do you understand? You do them as other parts of yourself.
No, I don't.
We're still children.
No, I don't.
It's true.
In 1976, millions of Americans watched Sybil, a TV movie based on a blockbuster book of the same name.
Sybil really introduced the country to the notion that someone could have multiple personalities.
Said to have 16 distinct personalities, Sybil had a story that was emotional and terrifying.
That's me?
How did you figure out that you had this multiple personality disorder?
So how did a rarely diagnosed psychological disorder turn into a cultural phenomenon?
Sometimes the media is the brilliant hysteric in the mix, and that can be the problem.
In the early 1950s, two doctors stunned the public with a patient they called Eve. Eve was a housewife from Georgia who appeared to have three distinct personalities.
Could I speak with Eve Blackman?
Sure.
Eve Black?
I feel good.
No psychiatrist in the United States in 1954 was unaware of this case.
Including Dr. Cornelia Wilbur and a patient she was treating in the fall of 1954 named Shirley Mason, who would later become known as Sybil. At the time, Mason was a graduate student living in New York, but she had severe emotional problems that had long seemed to be taking over her life. Dr. David Spiegel's father would see Mason when Dr. Wilbur was on vacation.
What we know is there was something seriously wrong. She didn't have a normal life despite being so intelligent.
Mason had met Dr. Wilbur 9 years earlier in Omaha, Nebraska. Even then, Dr. Wilbur had been interested in multiple personality disorder.
And she even recommended that Shirley read a classic book about multiple personality.
Then, several months after their therapy began in New York, Mason arrived at Wilbur's office acting different.
She came in seeming very little girlish, and she said something like, "Hi, I'm Peggy."
To explore this further, Wilbur began an aggressive treatment similar to one she had used as a young psychiatrist. Back then, she would delve into the unconscious mind by injecting mentally ill patients with hypnotic drugs, or so-called truth serums. Now she used this technique on Mason.
Now you look at me and you begin head sleepy. 1, 2, 3, and you may go to sleep. Something happened last night at 10 minutes after 10. What happened?
She dialed.
Who is she?
That other girl.
What's her name? You know it?
I don't know her name.
Yes, dear, you do.
No, doctor, don't know her name. I don't see her very many times.
And what did she say?
She talked to me.
And what did she talk about?
I feel sick.
It's all right, sweetie. What's your name?
I'm Shirley.
Mm-hmm. She said her name was Shirley. How old are you?
11.
Mm-hmm. So there are two Shirleys, the 11-year-old Shirley and the grown-up Shirley. Right? What stopped you from growing up, sweetie? Sweetie? Sweetie?
Dr. Wilbur ultimately identified 16 distinct personalities.
There was a little girl who called herself the grandmother. She had a little boy personality named Mike. There was Vicky, and she had another one named Peggy Ann.
And Wilbur had a strong suspicion about what caused Mason's other selves.
Dr. Wilbur was looking for trauma. She had this idea that something terrible had made Shirley split. She didn't really know what it was, so Shirley would be questioned pretty ruthlessly about things that her mother might have done to her, with a lot of specific suggestions by Dr. Wilbur. And what she, quote, remembered, unquote, was her mother tying her up, sticking implements up her genitals, all kinds of really terrible things.
Rather than publishing her findings in a scientific journal, Dr. Wilbur approached a journalist friend, Flora Schreiber, about the possibility of writing a mass-market book. She agreed, but only if Mason's personalities had merged. 3 years later, Schreiber got a call from Shirley Mason.
Flora Schreiber came over to Shirley's apartment, and she'd had some sort of a fit. She fell down, writhing, and then jumped up and jumped all over the place. After that, she was integrated. That's the way it was described by Flora Schreiber. She was integrated.
Their book, Sybil, sold more than 6 million copies.
You call me sweetie?
And the TV movie that followed was a smash hit, turning the story into a sensation.
My next two guests have an amazing and frightening story. Will you welcome, please, Dr. Cornelia Wilbur and Professor Flora Schreiber. This is just one of the most fascinating cases, I guess, that's ever happened in psychiatric history. Do you have a feeling that there are a lot more of them that never come to light?
Yes, I do. It's that the doctors don't recognize it.
Has anybody suggested this is a hoax? He needed some evidence.
A hoax has been breathed down our necks by various people at various stages of this project. Actually, it isn't a hoax. Tragically, it isn't a hoax. It would be much better for Sybil and possibly for all of us if it were, because this was dreadful to bear. This is true. It doesn't sound plausible. It doesn't sound possible. But true, it is. Yeah.
Before Sybil, multiple personality disorder was so rare that only 100 cases had ever been reported in the medical literature. Less than a decade later, in 1980, the American Psychiatric Association officially recognized the disorder, and the number of patients diagnosed rose into the thousands.
Are you with me?
No.
You really believe these are all distinct personalities, different?
Oh, without a doubt.
you could see it.
Today we're talking with people who have been diagnosed with multiple personality disorder. I'd like you to meet Kim. She says she has at least 15 different personalities in her body.
Today we'll meet Ray Lynn, a woman raising four kids while struggling with over 300 personalities inside her mind.
After the public fascination with this, entire hospital units were turned into treatment centers for multiple personality disorder.
Dr. Wilbur, too, would open her own treatment center.
Let's talk to Susie. We can begin to grow up.
The personalities are all perfectly whole, but they're totally separate people.
I came in for depression, and I left with multiple personalities.
In the mid-80s, 29-year-old Jeanette Bartha, who had suffered for years with clinical depression, was also diagnosed with multiple personality disorder by her psychiatrist.
It was probably our first or second session. He asked me who he was talking to. I just said, I just feel like a boy. And I was wearing a boy's shirt. And his response was, who am I talking to? What's your name? And it was very confusing. I didn't know what he meant. And he just kept saying, what's your name? Who am I talking to? So I gave him the first name that popped into my mind. And I said, Danny.
Her psychiatrist conducted therapy sessions under hypnotic drugs. Over time, Bartha says she came to believe not only that she had multiple personalities, but that it stemmed from her parents abusing her as members of a satanic cult.
Was that when you were inducted into the cult?
Yes.
I would get horribly upset thinking that your parents horrifically abused you. Was very, very difficult. And I take more medication in order to cope with that.
Bartha would spend 6 years in and out of mental hospitals. Then, as she started exercising and cutting back on her medication, she says she had a revelation.
All of a sudden, I said, oh my God, wait a minute, this didn't happen. And I just sunk to the floor and I said, what happened? What did I do?
Bartha wasn't the only one questioning her diagnosis and the trauma she once believed had caused it. In the 1990s, lawsuits were filed by other MPD patients, many who also linked their disorder to recovered memories of satanic ritual abuse when they realized there was little evidence that such abuse had actually occurred.
Many women who went into therapy and developed what are today called false memories developed those around treatment for multiple personality disorder.
The notion of hypnotizing people, the notion of calling them by different names to label different aspects of their personality, the notion of using sodium pentothal to get at repressed memories that otherwise would be utterly inaccessible to their conscious mind, that has been so debunked. It's radioactive, even though at one time that was seen as a necessary way to promote healing.
Today, MPD is not an official diagnosis. The American Psychiatric Association now calls it dissociative identity disorder, or DID.
The MPD thing had gotten to be such a lightning rod in the field as we move into the 1990s and late 80s that it probably was better to give it a little more boring name, perhaps.
Dr. David Spiegel of Stanford University, who headed up the committee that pushed for the change, says that part of the reason was to clear up the public misconception that rose from the name.
Multiple personality carries with it the implication that they really have more than one personality. That's what the name says. Dissociative identity disorder implies that the problem is fragmentation of identity, not that you really are 12 people, that you have not more than one but less than one personality.
He continues to study and treat the disorder.
The way to understand it in everyday life, you know, we're different people when we're at a party, hopefully, than we are when we're at work. These individuals have trouble integrating those aspects.
But what about Shirley Mason? Dr. Spiegel remembers that his father doubted she had multiple personalities, and that was nearly 60 years ago.
He referred to her as a brilliant hysteric. He felt that Dr. Wilbur tended to pressure her to exaggerate on the dissociation she already had. So she was capable of it. She was very hypnotizable.
Dr. Wilbur died in 1992, leaving Mason $25,000 in her will. Not long before Mason's death, 6 years later, she told a friend that every word in the book was true.
I think it's important to look back at Sybil because it's important to understand which stories are true and which are false. Because in some cases, like this one, they're not just stories. I mean, they actually end up affecting the law, affecting mental health, affecting political decisions. And the stuff that sounds the most dramatic and yet the most credible at the same time is probably the most dangerous.
I would like anyone who is listening to consider some thoughts that I paraphrase from the words of German pastor Martin Niemöller. You might not care if Donald Trump says Muslims must register with their government because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump says he's going to round up all the Hispanic immigrants because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump says it's okay to rough up black protesters because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump wants to suppress journalists because you're not one. But think about this. If he keeps going and he actually becomes president, he might just get around to you. And you better hope that there's someone left to help you.
What's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying, for Men in Hip Hop. Really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable, you know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about, it shouldn't be supported, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her, and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो
थाहा छ सन् 1988 मा
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए कसले के गरे
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी बहन गर्यौं तपाईले गर्नुभयो
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं जिम्मेवारी बहन गरौं
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास
Fuck you, Trump. We'll see you on the streets. Am I disappointed? Yes. But am I surprised? Hell no.
It clearly shows what the country is made up of, what the country was founded on.
Darwin described the United States as a greedy, hypocritical, racist, white supremacist, evil, warmongering nation.
Donald Trump is just a symptom of a greater system that has basically f***ed up for my people for over 500 years.
To me, the United States was founded in violence, developed in violence, and violence is an American, U.S. American tradition.
The thing that's rattling around in my brain is all of this militarized police and the attacks and everything that's been happening happened under the Obama administration. And I can't help but question what might happen under a Trump administration.
Now we have a really strong enemy to organize against that causes us to say, hey, we gotta get together.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This ends our news flash.